Many of us have learned by now that history is far from what we've been taught in school. More so, it appears that it's some of our most esteemed institutions that have had a hand in obscuring our distant past from our awareness, such as the Smithsonian. Richard Dewhurst has chronicled a surprising story of giants who he says ruled America in our ancient past, which also puts the notion of indigenous peoples into a new light. He's here to talk to us about his research today and also share what has been hidden by the Smithsonian and other institutions. Welcome. We've been trying to do this since December, but snowstorms and other things have kept you away until now. I'm so glad you're here.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. We finally made it.
That's it. So, first of all, you're a very tall man yourself. You're 6'6", which is tall. Mm-hmm. This tall for normal human standards
today. It
qualifies
me at the very bottom of the giant.
Bottom of the giant's top of normal humans. So, give us a little bit of a sketch as to what intrigued you. I know your own height was of interest, but what intrigued you into the studying this subject so deeply?
Well, I mean, the first thing was when I discovered I was going to be tall, I started having fascination with giant stories. And as a journalist and filmmaker, documentary filmmaker, I had a file of unusual stories. And over the years, I would clip giant references and so on and so forth, and never really thought that much about it, honestly. And several years ago, I was looking for a project to do, and I was going through the file, and I said, I'm going to check out this giant stuff, you know, and subscribed to several online newspaper archive services and began an in-depth research on it. And at first, I couldn't find a lot of the articles, and then I used the word search for a headline, and I think the first one I put in was Giant Skeletons Unearthed, and I found 30 articles. And that just, that was like going down Alice's rabbit hole.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, I ended up with over 800 stories, legitimate mm-hmm. accounts, every state in the Union, all the way down to Florida, all the way. My belief in mythology, but I also had to rethink everything I'd been taught in school about American history, because this race of giants are the same as the mound builders, and the mound builders have been literally forgotten. And part of the reason the mound builders are forgotten is they have no official status with the government. In order to have government protection, you need someone to step forward and say, I'm a descendant of this tribe. Nobody's ever stepped forward
right.
and said, I'm a descendant of the mound builders.
Right.
Now, I joked with some friends of mine that we should get Conan O'Brien and Bill Walton to step forward
right.
and say, I have red hair, I'm a giant, let's protect these things.
Right. Well, of course, because that history is long gone, and we really go only so far back as what we now consider to be the indigenous peoples of this country, which is really very modern history.
Mm-hmm.
Compared to what we're talking about. And as I remember in reading the book, there is a certain protection, as you say, that you have. The Native Americans in this country, for example, have a certain protection.
Well, since the 90s, they have the NAGPRA law, and that's the Native American Graves and Repatriation Act, which is basically a reburial policy.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why in the last 20 years, 30 years, we've seen nothing about any skeletons, because once anything is unearthed, it's immediately assigned to the local Indian tribe
right.
and reburied.
Right.
And the scientists in the last 20 years have had several run-ins with the local Indians, especially the Kennewick Man out west, which was dated to 9,000 years old skeleton with genome X chromosome, which is a Caucasian indicator.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing happened in Illinois, where they had a huge display for 50 years. It was the most popular thing in the state of mound builders and skeletons in situ. Local Indians said those are ours. Scientists will come forward and try and study the stuff. The Kennewick case was in the courts for 10 years before the scientists finally got their skeletons back to examine.
So, interestingly, the Native American tribes are actually obscuring the history too now.
They are.
Yeah.
Even though their own legends say that there was once a race of giants, and when you ask them, did you make this earthwork? No, this was done by the previous mound builders and the
right,
giants.
Right. But as you say, there's no one to speak for them. So what's interesting is because it was a more agrarian society mm-hmm. at that time, most of these juicy, wonderful articles come from newspaper clippings from the 1800s and early 1900s. But before we get to any of that and get to the artifacts themselves, let's talk about the medium, so to speak, the intellectual medium that existed in which all of these discoveries were made, because you can't go there without John Wesley Powell coming into the picture. And let's talk about who he was and why he was such a prominent figure in really even obscuring information.
Well, John Wesley Harding, John Wesley Powell, sorry, was one of the most prominent Western explorers and was intimately involved in discovery of Green River and the Grand Canyon. Mm-hmm. And by extension, he was assumed to know something about the ethnology of the local Indian tribes. So he was appointed in 1879 as the first director of ethnology. Now, Powell had what was called Powell Doctrine, and that was the first paper that he issued on behalf of the Smithsonian. Prior to that, the Smithsonian's first book in 1848 was a very open-minded study of the Mound Builder culture of the Mississippi. But by 1879, Powell unequivocally said, we're dealing with Aboriginal savages with no signs of advanced culture, no signs of higher intellect. He said, there is absolutely no pre-Columbian contact. We will not accept that. And any talk of lost tribes will not even be considered. Now, interestingly enough, Powell's father was a preacher who lost his whole congregation to Mormons.
Oh, interesting.
So no lost tribes for him.
Yeah, no lost tribes for him.
And this dovetailed with other Smithsonian policies, and primarily evolution. Now, in the 19th century, when we had our modern scientific institutions, they prided themselves on rationality. So anything to do with religion or myth was like a curse. And the whole idea of evolution is that we go from knuckle draggers and we're getting bigger and smarter. Well, you can't have a chart where, you know,
right,
you got 12, 10, 8, 7,
we
6.
We have a descending height.
It's called de-evolution.
Exactly.
The band Devo actually was named after that concept.
Right.
So
he was able to influence the Smithsonian, and as a result of that, most of the other journals of the day that would have been considered the more headier academic journals of the day bought into the mindset.
And
it was dovetailing with Darwinism, right?
Correct. Yeah. It was a perfect storm. Mm-hmm. And all of the universities took their lead from the Smithsonian.
Mm-hmm.
And the Powell Doctrine has never been rescinded. Even though there's people internally at the Smithsonian now that are trying to argue their way out of that box and doing some interesting work. It basically, after Powell, Doolittle, and then Arlush Heldrushka, who was the man who came up with the Bering Strait theory.
Right.
Now, the Bering Strait theory.
The land bridge.
They came, you know, out of Russia, mm-hmm, and through Alaska, down this little corridor of ice,
right,
by the way, which has been proven to be totally impossible.
Right.
No mention what they ate, you know, surrounded by all this ice. And in the book 1491, they estimate in there that Heldrushka put 30,000 skeletons into storage without examination or cataloging.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Now, in his case, he didn't want any kind of European contact because, mm-hmm, it blew his, you know, mm-hmm, scientific theory,
sure,
which was, the official policy of the Smithsonian.
Right. And so at this time, the arrogance and thinking was such, and we have been indoctrinated into that as well, that when you see these pictographs, whether it's in, whether it's through Egyptian artworks or American native artworks about ancient pasts or Aboriginal artworks where you have giant beings, we've taken that to be metaphorical.
Correct.
And that is the stance of academia, is that this is all metaphorical.
Right, that there were basically children who were trying to create things bigger than ourselves, the, mm-hmm, biblical stories about Goliath, or stories of the frost giants, stories of the titans, all of this was a result of adolescent thinking, again, in line with the idea of evolution.
Right.
You know, we've outgrown that.
Yes, we have outgrown that. However, academia has not outgrown that. That's why we're doing what we're doing today.
No, actually, the adolescents are the academics.
Yes.
And they're holding on to their little,
yes,
bottle, and they won't let anyone else,
yes,
you know. And if you say anything, you know, it's mine.
I mean, they're so so much evidence against evolution as it was drawn up by Darwin. I think he even had doubts himself, as the story goes, and we know his associate
did. We know that birds were dinosaurs,
yes,
correct?
Yes.
Birds didn't grow into dinosaurs. Dinosaurs became birds.
Yes, you know? Yes. I mean, there's so much evidence just on a genetic level alone, so we won't even debate any of that. Let's talk about what happened. Charles Doolittle Walcott, where did he come in, and what was his influence on archaeology and such then?
He just picked up the same policies and mm-hmm. reinforced them and made them the official policy of the 20th century. So it carried over again. And it's carried over to the present day. And they all hold ranks with each other and enforce the party line.
And it also, there's a giggle factor that is kept solidly in place. Again, we were talking off camera about the fact, once you have your academic institutions and your religious and your media, religious institutions, media and such, that are all essentially conspiring to give us a reflection of humanity that is very small, mm-hmm. very limited,
they
without
don't want
texture.
Us thinking big.
They don't want us thinking big.
They don't
exactly.
want us being proud.
Yeah.
You know, they don't want great anything.
Right. And yet, when you start looking at the evidence of what you've come across, I mean, I had looked into some of this many years ago as well, probably about the same time when you first started doing this research. And I remember finding it so interesting, these obscure little articles from Ohio, and especially in the Midwest, from the late 1800s, where someone would be digging around in their garden and stumble across a massive femur of some kind. And again, that has been completely obscured.
They were dismissed as hoaxes,
yes,
animal bones.
Exactly.
But in the 19th century, amazing quote that I used in the beginning of the book from Abraham Lincoln, who was making a speech at Niagara Falls in 1848. And he said, "The eyes of that extinct species of giant, whose bones fill the mounds of America, gaze on Niagara as ours do now." So it shows you just how widespread the knowledge of the giants was in
yes.
the 19th century. Now, the interesting thing about that is he gave that speech unknowingly at the site of a giant city that was up in that area, where they found numerous 7 to 9 foot giants. Then a little south of there in Cayuga Township was what was called the Cemetery of Giants, where they found 200 giant skeletons 7 to 9 feet tall. A little farther down the state, they found 150 seven
yes.
to nine footers. Pennsylvania, more, and all the way out to Catalina Island. And Catalina Island is in the 1920s this happened. International News front page Sunday supplement feature articles. 3,781 skeletons dug up by the Catalina Museum. Dr. Ralph Glidden headed the dig.
I just find it such an amazing conspiracy.
And then they call him a crackpot.
Yeah, okay? A crackpot.
He was the curator of the museum, and he headed the Hay Foundation, which was officially part of the Smithsonian.
Yes.
And in the book, I show that the Smithsonian has 536 negatives from those digs, and we're trying right now to get the Smithsonian to come forward and show what those images are, and it'll be very interesting.
Absolutely. What piqued my curiosity about 15 years ago is I'd stumbled across the story about the cache of Egyptian artifacts that were in the Grand Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember going to a lecture of a man who, he was an archaeologist. He also did his own digs. Not only was he showing the location of that particular cave in which those
it's at the confluence of the Little Colorado and the Colorado River.
It's on the side of a very steep drop off. This is not an easy place
right.
to get into. So it makes you wonder first, A, how did that stuff get in there? You have to start looking at other means of transportation to fly that kind of cache of a sizable amount of Egyptian artifacts in there. And the Smithsonian, then the article made it to the Phoenix Sun back mm-hmm. in what, 1910?
Huge article.
The Smithsonian comes in. It's all covered up.
We don't know who these people are.
We don't know who they are. They've spirited everything away. And mm-hmm. so this man had been in the cave. He had seen it. And he said it's very, very difficult to access.
Well, and the legends in the area say that the entrance of the Sipapu, which was where the Indians went to survive the apocalypse mm-hmm. with the ant people.
Ant people. people.
The ant people. And everyone thinks they're talking about ants. I think they're talking about the survivors of Atlantis, mm-hmm. A-N-T.
Mm-hmm.
And in the book also, you have the Sons of Anak, which is in the Book of Numbers, where they say, we came into this strange land inhabited by giants, before whom we stood like grasshoppers.
Mm-hmm.
And you just find the myths over and over again, reinforcing the same themes with the same root words, you know, with the same associations. By extension, in Death Valley, they found a similar underground temple in 50 connecting caves. 8 to 9 foot giants dressed in what they called sheepskin looking zoot suits.
We're going to get to that. I just find this so fascinating. Yeah. And the same man that was talking about the cave in the Grand Canyon that had stored at one time the Egyptian artifacts before the Smithsonian came in and spirited everything away. He had also come across these clay tubes that were burial tubes. And this man, you and I were talking on camera, yeah. I cannot remember his name.
I was fascinated.
He agreed to do an interview with me, and then he said he's had so much harassment.
Now those were standing burials, correct?
They were standing burials, and these beings were anywhere between 9 and 15 feet tall. They had their clothing on, and I saw the images of them. Mm-hmm. They had hair, very red hair, bright orangish red hair. And you, as you're going to tell us in a little bit, a lot of these skeletons have blonde, waist-length black hair, red hair.
Correct.
That's still intact.
Catalina
after
was blonde, red hair all over the country, including Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Black hair often, again, I'm not saying that all the population of the Americas was Caucasian or giants, but the main central burials in the majority of the major mounds across America, and again, you have to understand, hundreds of thousands of mounds in the Americas. The Smithsonian themselves estimated over 150,000 mounds in the East Coast alone. People don't think there's any mounds out west. Well, out west is covered with mounds.
Yes.
There was Lake Lahontan, which was at 5,000 feet in the California, Nevada, Arizona border. It was big as the Great Lakes. That's where Spirit Cave, Lovelock Cave mm-hmm. has been found.
Mm-hmm.
It's in association with the temple complexes in Death Valley and the Grand Canyon, and the finds all the way through California.
Okay, now, in ancient lore, and certainly about Atlantean times, it's often discussed that the people were very large in stature.
Mm-hmm.
And so if there were these confluences historically of events that were occurring, if you were having events that required having to leave a given area and migrate to other places, certainly it's not beyond reason that we could expect to see these same people, these same types of beings arriving in the Americas. I don't know why we think, because we've been given such a virginal history, except for a few savages.
History, you know, everything came out of the Mideast, you know, and but magically, these cultures, Egyptian and Sumerian, that appeared in the Mideast, appeared at their highest form of culture
exactly.
and then degenerated.
Exactly.
And when you ask them, well, how is this possible? They said, well, you know, the history, you know, I mean, things like that happen. Well, no, they don't.
You know, they don't. That's devolution.
These were clearly civilizations brought in at a high level from somewhere else.
Right. Okay, now, just to get a perspective here, we're going to go to Robert Wadlow.
Okay.
And I think many people have probably seen some of his photos. We have a few other family photos of him while we talk about
now,
him.
He was 8'4", in that he made it to 8'11", but he only lived to be 22. He suffered from a pituitary condition. He had a tumor in his pituitary gland.
Yes.
Now, the giants that we found in the mounds are clearly not suffering from gigantism, as they call it.
Right. And this man, just as a matter of scale, as we can see here, he's 8'4". We're talking about giants, the rulers in particular, who ranged between 9 and 12 feet tall, just as a matter of scale. And I want to bring up something. Do you know who Klaus Dohna is by any chance?
Oh, yes, for everyone.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he's a friend of mine, and I've gotten to know him through
amazing
our work.
Amazing stuff. Yeah.
Amazing stuff. And in one of the interviews I did with him, I was at his apartment in Austria, I believe we're in Austria, and he handed me the occipital bone of a person, and this had gone through university examination mm-hmm. and so forth, that they determined to be between 23 and 25 feet tall.
Right.
Now, again,
there's a whole other
Robert
class
is
of findings.
9 feet tall max in what we just saw there. So you have to look at what's going on. And I want to bring up something we talked about briefly off camera too, the pituitary. Mm. So he had a pituitary tumor that created this gigantism, mm-hmm. right? But we know when you go into the ancient studies, the classic ancient studies, the pituitary is responsible for
it's a central
our growth,
spiritual,
our spiritual
it's
evolution,
also was considered
all of
the most
it.
Important gland all, in general by the ancients. So,
exactly. And so what was going on there? Is it possible that this devolution, the tiny stature we have now, is really more a process of having a negatively impacted pituitary?
I agree. My personal opinion, you know, is that when you take out diet and nutrition, you know, which is why they always say, oh, we're getting bigger and stuff. I mean, when you go back into a really ancient culture with high spiritual practices, with the, it's even conceivable stimulation of the pituitary.
Exactly.
Could have resulted in some of this growth.
Yeah, exactly. It's just something worth thinking mm-hmm. about, because our assumptions are so backward in what the human species
and
is
so,
to begin with.
And so restricted.
And so restricted. Okay, so one of the things that we were talking about is the leaders in these mounds were usually between 7 and 9 feet tall. So he would have been a normal, mm-hmm. Robert would have been a rather average looking sized right. fellow from that time. But also there was a fineness of features, of strength, a mm-hmm. real broadness, their broad shoulders. These were fully, it wasn't gigantism, these were fully intact, very
fully
powerful
articulated
human beings.
By all means, it looks like beautiful looking people. And this is in association with the copper and mica jewelry, the crown.
Yes.
You know, because they're buried in the middle of the mound and they're
right.
wearing a copper crown.
Crown.
You know, it's a tip-off.
And also, again, the copper crowned, the crown and any other jewels that are associated with crowns have to directly to do with the pituitary gland. Mm. They always did, historically.
Interesting.
So, yeah. And so this woman was buried with the king. And let's talk about the position they were buried in.
Sometimes you have couples with their knees intertwined, sitting, facing each other. In two cases, holding stela mm-hmm. with hieroglyphs.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get a number of standing burials, sometimes surrounded by standing stones.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's something called sun circle burials, where it'll be a group of 8, 10, 12 individuals all facing in, and then the king usually in a standing position in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
So just an incredible variety. And again, when people talk about hoaxes and stuff, what I always say, and I try to include in the book, was the associated burial positions and the associated grave goods. Now, you might be able to fake a giant bone here or there, but we're talking about detailed grave goods, high degrees of pottery.
Let's talk about that. I mean, some of the art that has been found is absolutely, it's exquisite. We don't do any finer artwork today.
Mm-mm.
I mean, almost as though it's been machined.
Yeah.
Because of the evenness and smoothness of texture, the fineness of the features. And again, in association with these giants. Just explain some of the pieces that you've come across. This, look at this beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, that's considered one of the finest pieces of pottery discovered in the Americas. And you can just see the almost machine mm-hmm. quality
mm-hmm.
to it.
Mm-hmm.
And in association with the Catalina finds, there was a 65-pound urn which they found in the burial site, and everyone commented that it seemed to have been machined. It was of such high quality.
Mm-hmm.
And this doesn't just apply to pottery, it goes right across the board into accounts of dams, irrigation systems, the pipes alone that come out of the mounds. A majority of the ones in the book are from West Virginia. Where in 1883, I found the Smithsonian's own field report, which said they found three giants.
Mm-hmm.
This is very famous, came out
yes.
of Iowa. A lot of controversy at the time as to whether it was an elephant or a mammoth. The people that were trying to be conservative were saying it was an elephant. Of course, there's no history of elephants in the Americas either. But people that know anatomy seem to think it's a mammoth, in which case this degree of accuracy would have had to have been observed 10 or 20,000 years ago.
And this degree of artistry.
Yeah. The artistry of the pipes and carvings was one of the things that really just blew me away. Because these things are being found in association with the giant barrels and associate barrels that aren't giants. You know? Mm-hmm. But the degree of sophistication artistry is across the board much higher than what was associated with the later American Indians. And if you ask the American Indians, again, they say, you know, this is from a prior culture.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of the other finery, because they had sophisticated jewelry as well. Mm. Copper seemed to be the medium that was used the most. And as you say, yeah. The freshwater pearls, wherever they found them.
And mica.
And mica, mm-hmm. and mica. And so there was a lot of beautiful jewelry that was associated, but also one thing I found intriguing, going to the Louvre and the and also the British Museum on Egyptology, is the games, the kind, mm-hmm. the sophisticated board games and such that
and
existed.
Children's games
and
as
children's
well.
Games yeah. that existed. So those same accoutrements were
American
found
mounds.
Yeah, yeah. in these American mounds. Mm-hmm. What are some of the other things that were found by way of fabric, for example? Because you talked about these zoot suits.
Well, there's two incredible things out west. One is the finds in the Death Valley Caves, where they go into detail about these sheepskin-looking zoot suits mm-hmm. that were, you know, apparently tailored pants and coats and buttons. And in that case, there was a series of connected temple rooms that all led to what they characterized as almost looking like a museum, where they had niches with the bones of saber-toothed tigers, giant sloths, mammoths, and dinosaurs.
Saber-toothed tigers.
Right. And dinosaurs. Now, people say, okay, well, this is ridiculous, but let me just make this one point. The Inca stones in South America also showed giants, and there's cave petroglyphs in Nevada that showed dinosaurs. Now, I know this seems crazy, but in the last 10 years, scientists in Germany and at North Carolina State both began independently cutting open giant bones, which has never been done before because they were considered too valuable. And they found soft tissue within these dinosaur bones that's been dated to 20 to 36,000 BC. And these papers, there was a huge scientific conference in Singapore where they presented these findings. The woman at North Carolina State has been under attack for the last 10 years over all this.
Interesting.
But I'm just putting it out there.
Yes.
The other amazing thing about fabrics was found in Spirit Cave out in Nevada, which is associated with Lake Lahontan again. And they were excavating bat guano out of there. And under several feet, they started to discover what looked like human remains. And they had to contact the University of Nevada, and an archaeologist came out, took a look at it. What they found was three skeletons mummified and wrapped in very fine tule fiber fabric with like Egyptian thread count. It was that advanced. They asked, this was in the 1940s, they looked at the stuff, they said, well, it appears to be 500,000 years old, and immediately filed it away. In the late 90s...
Just a casual comment, 500,000 right. years old.
No, 500.
Oh, 500 to 1,000?
1,000 years. So a scientist at the University of California read about this in the 90s, and he went to Nevada and found the things in storage, pulled them out of storage, and carbon dated them to 7,500 BC. Mummification and advanced weaving. There's a
yes,
shot of,
yes.
of the shroud in the book.
Yes.
Now, one would think the news of a 7,500-year-old mummified anything anywhere in the world would have been a sensation. No one knows about it.
No. Okay, so fabric. So sophisticated fabric weaving. We know at least that far back.
7,500
years at least.
And associated with the copper finds, you know, I said to myself, where's all the copper coming from? Well, it turns out northern Michigan, Keweenaw Peninsula, and then by extension into the lake, there's something called Isle Royale, which I find is a very interesting name for it, number one, the Royal Island. Mm-hmm. And that island is literally made out of copper, and because of a volcanic upthrust, the copper was exposed to the air, all the sulfur impurities burned off. So it's over 99% pure. Two professors in Michigan wrote a book and estimated that 1.5 billion pounds of copper were taken out of there over a period of 10,000 years.
Well, besides the jewelry and such, what else, what other remnants have you found in terms of what the copper was used for?
Well, they can't account for it. They say, well, in the mounds,
that's a lot of jewelry.
We see a lot of jewelry. Yeah. And a lot of independent researchers up in that area have reported petroglyphs of Cretan-looking ships, mm-hmm. Egyptian-looking vessels, mm-hmm. all the way to the Vikings. Now, it's very interesting. The copper trade fell off in 1500 BC and started back up at 900 AD. In 1500 BC, the Santorini volcanic explosion in Crete happened, which, among other things, I think accounts for the Exodus story and completely destroyed that seagoing culture. Mm-hmm. So it would make sense that the copper trade dropped off. Mm-hmm. And then it started up at 900 AD, which is exactly the time they say the Vikings showed up.
Mm-hmm. You were talking about pipes earlier. Were the mm-hmm. pipes made of copper?
Mostly soapstone and some very mm-hmm. hard stones.
Were you impressed more with the precision with which these
yeah.
were made?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And how it was worked. It's the same story. You get this, high degree of granite and stuff like that seems to have been easily manipulated and worked on, mm-hmm. and science, says they had crude instruments, they didn't know this, they didn't know that, and they do it with the Great Pyramid and the Great Stones of Baalbek and come up with these ridiculous stories in order to make people from the extreme past look ignorant children.
Yes, people like you and Klaus Dohna and Christopher Dunn, though, I have such respect for. He's done amazing research in terms of showing that it was virtually impossible for some of those megalithic statues. Laser-like precision. Yeah. Obviously, a lot of the statuary in Egypt was machine-tooled.
Yeah,
back
no
in
question.
Its day. Yeah,
I mean he's done photos where he's taken like the face of Ramses and shown that. You can put the right cheek against the left.
Perfect.
It's perfect.
Flawless.
Yeah. Yeah. He says the only way you can do that is with a computer program.
So we're looking at a society, and we've started slowly coming to embrace. Yes, there were in the Middle East maybe some more advanced civilizations, but we haven't gotten to the point because your work is really relatively new and phenomenal. Mm-hmm. That the same thing was going on all over the planet.
Right. Well, I joke at one point, especially in light of the finds out west, which we know were 7,500 BC. And by the way, also the Florida bog mummies. And the Florida bog mummy stories is another just mind blower. They were putting in a condominium complex near Disney World in Titusville, which is on the Atlantic coast, and the developers drained a lake there, and they discovered under the peat moss skeletons. So they contacted the University of Florida and Florida State. They came out, started digging in there, and what they discovered was several hundred red-haired, mummified skeletons. The hair was still in a knot, and they'd been ritually buried with stakes. Couldn't get any funding for it at all.
Can you believe that?
They had to raise independent funds, and the developers, on their own dime, put up $60,000 worth of machines so they could drain this stuff out. This took 10, 15 years. Finally, the University of Florida in the last couple of years has stepped forward by a grant from a private individual who allowed them to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing happened on the west coast of Florida. They had health spas over on the west coast, and in the 50s, they were very popular, and people would come down on vacation. And one of the guys was an ex-Navy diver, and he started scuba diving and coming up with skeletons.
And then the tourists started coming up with skeletons, and he tried to get the government involved. No success at all. And in the case of the West Coast, they're actually cenotes. They thought they were only 40 feet deep, and they're shaped like an hourglass, and they come back out, and at the bottom is peat moss, and underneath the peat moss, hundreds of red-haired skeletons, 75, dated 7500
BC. And the red-haired skeletons are all over the country.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So I joked at one point, you know, because they always say, well, when did the Europeans discover America? And I said, well, maybe you've got it like completely backwards, you know? I said, if you go back to 7500 BC, especially out west, that was considered the most lush biodiversity existing on the planet. So perhaps we discovered them.
Right.
And they didn't discover us at all.
There are so many question marks that come up when you start looking at all of this. I really don't even know where to go with it. It's just kind of, it's just data. At this point, it's just data. Trying to string it all together seems almost impossible, mm-hmm. unless you just stick to a particular locale and see that there was a particular very advanced or sophisticated culture of the day. So let's talk about the mounds themselves a little bit, mm-hmm. and let's talk about the ways in which the internal structure of the mounds were built and purpose and ceremony and that sort of thing.
Well, there were several different types of mounds.
Yeah. Here we have one.
That's a Monk's Mound, which is in Cahokia, which is in St. Louis at the confluence of three major rivers, and huge significance to the site. They originally estimate that the city of Cahokia was 50 to 60,000 people. In the last 2 years, the city of St. Louis has been doing extensive work on their sewers and roads, and they've discovered that they're finding Cahokian remains all over underneath St. Louis. They've upped the estimate to 100 to 150,000 people. Now we have...
When were the Cahokian? What is the age
Cahokia
estimate on that?
Well, Cahokia, again, fell in 1200 to 1500 AD as mound builder culture in mm-hmm. general across the country. People ask me, well, what happened? I personally think disease. I also think that the Mongol invasion went not only east but west and came into the Americas and probably brought the Black Plague with it. Mm-hmm. And so at Cahokia, the site has never been properly studied. The man that was officially assigned to do some tentative digs was also associated in covering up some of the extraordinary finds in Sayre, Pennsylvania, including the horned skull.
Yes, I was going to get to that next.
Which they squashed. It's the same guy. Yeah.
Now, okay. How? Like I said, I don't even know what to do with all of this.
I can't remember the guy's name, but the archaeologist that was involved in this find.
This is in Pennsylvania. Squashed,
yeah, Sayre, Pennsylvania. I was associated with Phillips Andover Academy. And again...
And it's a humanoid... Hard to say.
Yeah, I mean, some people think it's E.T., some people think it's, you know, a devil race, you know, but there's numerous accounts of horned giants and horned mythological figures.
Well, Michelangelo honored this himself.
Correct.
But...
And Alexander the Great was also, you know... There's,
he was said to
had horns.
Sport horns.
Yeah. I know.
I mean, but why did Michelangelo put horns on Moses?
Well... That's the big question.
Now, you would think there would people...
This should be a sensation.
This would be a sensation, but that people would be flocked around this all day long, asking
it's
the simple question,
the
why does he have horns?
Right.
This is Moses.
Occam's razor would tell you he has horns because he had horns.
Sometimes it's as obvious as that.
Right.
I mean, it's so absurd. Okay, so when you're so far, A, what is the largest skeleton that's been exhumed?
Yeah. The best account that I put in the book with multiple people, townspeople, doctors, scientists, so forth, was on the Ohio-Indiana border. Mm-hmm. They found an 18-footer there.
Wow.
With a 9-foot copper sword and an iron helmet that in the article they say resembled something from Nineveh.
Interesting.
That was by far the biggest. You have a range of 10 to 12 footers, a lot of them up in Minnesota in association with the copper mines up there, which again, I think is very interesting because, you know, Isle Royale being the Royal Island, you know, you would have your biggest giants protecting your most valuable assets. So, you know, it would make sense.
Mm-hmm.
Ohio, as we talked about earlier, we've got 9 footers.
Mm-hmm.
Next to the king and queen, they found a circle of mounds that had, I believe, 9 skeletons, 8 to 9 foot. So that was in mm-hmm. association with the other two. And then a lesser class, which is by far the most common, which are 7 to 9 feet.
Mm-hmm. And the ethnicity is really varied across the country. There was one, as I recall, one leader, 9-foot-tall man, was found with a little white-haired child.
Kentucky.
In Kentucky. Talk about that a little bit. And then also about the really spectacular sounding one with the waist-length black hair.
Mm-hmm.
He sounded just exquisite.
Yeah. Definitely should have been in some heavy metal rock band.
Yeah.
The Kentucky-Tennessee finds are amazing, and the most amazing account I found was Dr. John Haywood, and he not only made first-person on-site examinations, but also collected over 100 years of what he considered the most authentic finds in the area.
Mm-hmm.
The finds in Kentucky and Tennessee include secret caves, sacred springs, standing monolithic stones, 9-foot giants found with blonde-haired children, and what they called the moon-eyed children, which I thought was
yes,
very
the little teensy ones. Let's
Haywood
talk about those.
they were excavating mounds in Tennessee and Kentucky, and they kept noticing small mounds in association. And finally, they thought, well, let's just find out what's in these things. And they dug in, and what they essentially found were small coffins, 3 feet long, and inside them were bones of pygmies or midgets or leprechauns, whatever you want to call them. The Indians called them the moon-eyed children or the moon-eyed people, and they said that the moon-eyed people were associated with giants, always found in their company, only came out at night, and liked to create mischief.
Interesting. It's almost the story, as you say, of leprechauns.
Yeah, and I thought, well, this is the exact same thing that they're saying, you know, about leprechauns.
Yes.
They're on the cover is
yes.
one of the
yes.
children right
yes.
there. Yeah. So, a lot more to our heritage and history.
Okay, so then that brings us now to some speculation. And again, there is so much in this book. I just kind of snagged a little bit of this and that to inquire about, just to
thanks,
get some visual imagery. But let's talk about maybe an overarching theme throughout history. As we said in the very beginning, all of the indigenous peoples around the world have talked about giants.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the indigenous people around the world have also talked about their space brothers.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about the UFO and giant connection, or not UFO, just off-world cultures and our connection with other planetary systems.
Well, mythologically speaking, the Sumerians are probably the ones that we always look to, because when they talk about the Anunnaki,
right,
those are those from heaven to earth came.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that gets back into this A-N-A-N-T root that I was discussing earlier. The Anunnaki, in many accounts, and even in accounts of Gilgamesh, were a race of giants of an advanced technical culture.
Mm-hmm.
You have the sons of Anak in the Book of Numbers in the Bible, Anunnaki,
mm-hmm.
Anak,
mm-hmm.
Atlantis,
mm-hmm.
ant people. You know,
mm-hmm.
this root word crops up over and over again. So, by implication, if we use the forbidden word Atlantis, there seems to have been an advanced culture. It doesn't necessarily have to have come from outer space, though.
It could be indigenous.
Well,
yeah.
I often, you know, we have flying saucers,
yes.
Okay? We have airplanes. If we land an airplane in an aboriginal culture, wouldn't we be the ones from
exactly.
heaven to earth?
And you bring an example of that in the book forward that I thought was very interesting. Yes.
So, you know, I say, yes, they had vimanas or flying machines or whatever you want to call
them. In the Hindu culture, yeah.
I'll reserve whether, you know, they came from outer space or they just had the technology to be perceived as coming from space.
Mm-hmm. So through whatever means, it appears that advanced culture had been seeded here a long time ago. Mm-hmm. You're just arguing that it doesn't necessarily mean that it was seeded from elsewhere.
Yes, because you know, we have so much evidence and so many conflicting stories, and it's so hard to get some of this information across without being accused of being, you know, believing in too many out there things. So I just say that all my research indicates that there was an advanced civilization that had technological, scientific, I think they thought differently than we did and didn't try and make machines do things.
I was going to say, the technological piece is what's interesting to me.
They seem to have known how to sympathetically stimulate natural powers and currents and in a way that didn't interfere with the natural ecological systems. If you look at the mounds in America, there's not a lot of evidence for defensive structures.
Mm-hmm.
Although there's ritual burials in some cases of giants in full armor. And there's one very big mythological story that concerns the Lenni Lenape Indians, who say they originally came from out west, which would indicate 5000 BC when the Lassen volcano destroyed Lake Lahontan and that whole culture fell. Their stories say they came across the Mississippi and they ran into the Algonquin or Algonquin
Indians, mm-hmm.
who were also a race of giants.
Mm-hmm.
And a series of epic battles started that was eventually joined in by the Menengue. And the Lenni Lenape ended up victorious and eventually took over the Atlantic coast from Long Island, New York, down to around Delaware. But other than that, it doesn't seem to have been a warlike culture.
And, mm-hmm. Although it's interesting because some of the lore around Atlantis, for example, in various stages of Atlantis, was that they certainly had the abilities and had harnessed these natural forces, mm-hmm. as you say, whether it's sound, light, crystalline energies,
vibrations,
and so forth,
vibrations, yeah.
and to be able mm-hmm. to use it with, you know, form and thought.
And quantum mechanics.
It proves all of that. And so we know that existed. We don't know that. We're now assuming.
Coming closer to accepting
yeah. that mm-hmm. that kind of a very sophisticated culture existed. But then at the same time.
They degenerated.
Yes. Because you also have the lore that even while that existed, that kind of very peaceful, sophisticated culture, very advanced agricultural techniques and so forth, there were air raids and attacks from above, from craft from above. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I'm getting into, this notion of maybe a confluence of different off-planet cultures with ours. And you know, there's certainly...
Very conceivable.
Yeah. You know, conceivable. But, and
for instance, yes. down here, this is Poverty Point, and this is northern Louisiana. And again, you can see... It's laid out in a very non-defensive
mm-hmm.
way.
Mm-hmm.
There was a place called Circleville in Ohio that very much resembled that. they estimate that there could have been 100,000 people living here, by the way. And in Circleville in Ohio, this is bizarre, but when they occupied Circleville, they built the town in association with the existing circles. Then at some point in the 1830s, the town decided that they wanted to square the circles.
Yeah, sure, why not?
So they raised funds. It was called Squaring the Circle, and probably had Masonic implications. But they started squaring the whole thing. Then they just gave it up and plowed the whole thing under. And the stories like that are voluminous all over the country. Dam building, another great destroyer of a lot of this evidence.
Yes.
In Oklahoma, they put a dam in there. In the process, they found 100,000 plus city. People say, well, geez, in Oklahoma, well, they've got Cato Lake there and the Cato culture. The pottery we were looking at mm-hmm. earlier was from Cato culture. And an aquifer in Texas, which was also considered the biggest freshwater aquifer. And that's where they found the city for 100,000 people. Now they found evidence of huge ancient forges to work with metals. That was all flooded out. Out west, they put another dam out there. At some point, there was an estimate of a six mile long city. White Sands missile testing range mm-hmm. before they took that over. Association with the cliff dweller
yes.
culture, another 100,000 city. Niagara Falls yeah. indications 50 to 100,000 people. So our conception of what was here in the Americas is, I mean, we think, you know, everybody lived in teepees. You know?
Right.
Not true.
No, not true. And actually on the cliff dweller subject, I was going to do a documentary called The Mystery of the Cliff Dwellers a number of years ago, and I don't want to go into who and how this happened, but I came across some information from someone who would be in a position to have all of the elevations and such. And essentially what they're saying is they had hiked in the whole Four Corners region and noticed that there was a particular elevation at which all of this had occurred. And they essentially said there, just as kind of solving the cliff dweller, as a potential answer to the cliff dweller mystery, is that that had all been an inland sea. Well, everything is marked at the same level yeah. water-wise. The petrified forests included.
Well, Lake Lahontan was at 5,200 feet.
Exactly.
So all of the finds out west are above 5,000 feet.
And they're all right around 5,200
right.
feet. Including
and that's
a lot
true
of this.
Across the board over three or four or five states out there.
Yes.
And, you know, we've been led to believe the cliff dwellers are contemporaneous with the, you know, our modern Indians. I show in the book there's a 1910 report from the Smithsonian itself who says they estimate the site was at least 3,000 to 5,000 years old. That,
yes.
That the stairs are so weathered by human use that it would have taken thousands of years
exactly.
for that kind of wear.
So whatever kind of, in this one man's supposition on this is that whatever body of water was there is gone mm-hmm. now. And so it just leaves us to think that these people had reason to build defensively up on the side of these mountains when actually most likely they had boats right out in front, their little canoes, and
yeah.
their supplies came in via water.
Well, another absurdity of the Smithsonian was that no boats. You know, everybody had to walk over glaciers and stuff. Curiously, last month on Associated Research, I just found the Smithsonian's back on Santa Rosa Island, which is part of the Channel Islands
mm-hmm.
associated with Catalina.
Right.
Glidden found 1,500 more giants on the other islands, plus the Golden Gate Museum found stuff. UCLA supposedly has 200 of these skeletons at the Fowler Museum. Anyway, they're on Santa Rosa Island. They've gone back out to do digs on a plateau out there. Now, they haven't said they found any skeletons, but what they have said is that they have now established human habitation at least 10,000 BC and unquestionably the use of boats.
Yes. Okay, so, I mean, this is kind of, it's a nonlinear topic. This is kind of a nonlinear conversation because we're just trying to turn over stones and say, well, this is what they found here, this is what they found there. But it certainly is leading to, if we can't put a linear context to the development of civilization in the Americas because it was so diverse, we maybe can put a larger context to why it seems so necessary to hide that information from us. And we can finish on that note mm-hmm. because this is really something that is, in my mind, it's criminal.
Well, they talk about stories of Atlantis or the great stories of the Titans or Poseidon or biblical high culture, Sumerian high culture, dismissively, especially beginning in the 19th century. Prior to the 19th century, these ideas were embraced by the intelligentsia. Plato was held in high regard by Thomas Jefferson, among other people.
Yes.
The whole idea of the Atlantis stories was not some conspiracy theory, you know? The idea that high culture, that human history is highs and lows, peaks and valleys. Somehow we got it into our heads as we started, you know, inventing little machines and stuff like that. Nobody's ever done this before. We're smarter than everybody else. So therefore, you know, anything that indicates any high degree of technical sophistication associated with ancient history has been put in the bin of whack jobs and conspiracy theorists. And then we're starting to come out of that now.
Mm-hmm.
But You know, I think that's the underlying theme that's kept all this information from being really scientifically examined and accepted as part of our tradition and not part of myth.
Yes. Okay, now if someone has a little summertime vacation ahead, where would you suggest one go? If they want to go on a giant tour of America, what would be, say, 2 to 3 of the top spots to go where you can see some actual skeletal remains, mounds, and so forth? I know because this is spread all over the place.
Impossible today because of the NAGPRA laws.
Oh, yeah.
One of the last Native places American, that you could go was Nevada at the Humboldt the sites out there, the Winnemucca Museum, mm-hmm. had 4 giant skeletons that were on display. Then the state of Nevada said, we don't officially recognize these, and withdrew them. Then for a while, they were showing them in the back room. We're presently right now trying to get the Fowler Museum and the Smithsonian to open up some of this evidence. The very least show the 536 photographs from Catalina Island. Now, curiously, museum there was reincorporated as the Catalina Island Museum. 2 years ago, they were doing research in the storage rooms for an exhibit on World War II. They discovered Ralph Glidden's boxes and research material. This was covered in the Los Angeles Times. They go through the boxes, they say, this man was not a crackpot, apparently. All these stories seem to have been true. He was, an excellent archaeologist, worked very vigorously, we found all this stuff. No mention of the 3,781 skeletons that averaged 7 feet tall. Nobody from UCLA stepped forward and said, we have 200 of these. Nobody from the Smithsonian said, we have photos of all this. So
it's time to put a little pressure on the Smithsonian.
You got it.
Maybe that's the next
step.
That's
the next step if you want to see.
If you want to do something, yeah. If you want to see any of it.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, I hear Klaus is onto some interesting things right now.
Oh, good.
So I'm going to be catching up with him, too.
Keep me posted.
I certainly will. And thank you so much. I mean, I was just, it just kind of leaves your hair curled to think that here we have, you know, from 7 feet to 18 feet tall, 18 foot tall human beings, red hair, black hair, white hair.
I'll tell you the other thing people can do.
Yes.
In their neighborhoods, because mounds are all over the country.
Yes.
Keep your eyes open. If it looks like an artificial mound, it probably is an artificial mound.
Okay.
See if you can investigate it, you know, see if there's a local history regarding it, you know. Get actively involved. Look in your backyard.
Okay. Look in your backyard, put some pressure on mm-hmm. the Smithsonian.
You got it.
Thank you so much. I mean, you've done an amazing job of archiving all of this information, those articles and the photographs.
Very
Thank
kind.
You for your work.
Thank you.